I've sort of evolved and sort of transitioned a little bit into the digital ethics and technology ethics space, which is obviously a very hot topic at the moment, as we are seeing significant issues of technology misuse and malpractice in public space and affecting communities. But still, I am really driven by this idea of making sure that our public space maintains the sort of the same meaning and the same quality that it has historically always had for members of the public. And obviously, I try to form really strong opinions around how technology should align better with these sort of historical ideas and practices.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a really fascinating talk with Niels Wouters. Niels is a designer and researcher with a particular interest in identifying architectural qualities and engagement opportunities afforded by digital media in public space. Niels is currently Head of Research for Science Gallery Melbourne and Research Fellow in the School of Computing and Information Systems at the University of Melbourne. Firstly, Niels tells us about his very background in computer science and architecture, his PhD focused on human-computer interaction, and his current work in the smart cities or smart digital ethics space. He tells us how he came to work in the space of ethics, technology, and interaction in public spaces, the importance of quick and agile responses to ethical issues, before sharing with us what a smart community is to him. Niels then tells us about the biometric mirror project he's been working on and what's involved. We discuss the potential risks and biases associated with facial recognition systems, before Niels tells us about the project Decolonizing the Urban Screen, which he has been working on. We finish our conversation discussing the emerging trends of less facial recognition systems being used in some countries and more being used in others, and also the self-governance of data. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Niels. How are you today?
Hi, Zoe. Good morning. I'm pretty well, actually. Yeah, how are you?
I am very well. I'm very excited to have you on the podcast. So let's just jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you're passionate about?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm working in the sort of smart city space, digital ethics space, but I don't have the sort of typical profile or the profile that you would typically expect of a person working in this area. I'm a computer scientist in a very sort of distant past. So I know how to program in these days, I think, more the sort of outdated languages like COBOL, which is apparently a language from the 1970s, so used in banking. It's very boring. And Visual Basic, because that used to be a thing back in the day. So that only to say that this is like 15 years ago. I'm also an architect by training, so I know how to design a house. Probably also know how to make houses collapse. I've never practiced as an architect. And after these two degrees, I did a PhD with a very strong focus on human-computer interaction. And that really enabled me to bring the two disciplines together in one way or another and really look at how the public interacts with technology in public space, which is, of course, a sort of a really, really interesting area. It's been really sort of action-led research. I've done a lot of case studies with members of various communities, and that allowed me to form sort of guidelines for architects, urban planners, designers to more meaningfully integrate technology in public space. From there onwards, I've sort of evolved and sort of transitioned a little bit into the digital ethics and technology ethics space, which is obviously a very hot topic at the moment, as we are seeing significant issues of technology misuse and malpractice in public space and affecting communities. But still, I am really driven by this idea of making sure that our public space maintains the sort of the same meaning and the same quality that it has historically always had for members of the public. And obviously, I try to form really strong opinions around how technology should align better with these sort of historical ideas and practices.
Mm. And how did you get interested in this particular area of smart communities? So this ethics and technology and interaction in public space?
Probably a little bit unexpected. So during my PhD, for instance, one of my last case studies and one that I'm particularly sort of proud and satisfied with is that I worked with political refugees and I designed and delivered them with tools to tell their stories to their, back in the days, Belgian neighbors. So they had recently arrived in Belgium, but didn't really connect for a variety of reasons with their sort of community members. So we embarked on a sort of design exercise to let them tell their stories in their own way, which turned out to be a very visual way. We used the building as a means to communicate their narratives. And looking back on that project in the first instance, of course, personally, I found that extremely rewarding. These refugees invited me into their world, invited me in and enabled me to learn about the horrific stories of their past and of their present as well. So I felt very privileged. It was, the real emotional roller coaster. But also in retrospect, looking back at it, there were some ethical concerns. I wasn't, I guess, prepared enough to deal with some of the emotional impact of their stories. But also in return, I didn't provide them with the right means to be sort of psychologically protected in participating in that kind of research. So that's the sort of first flag where I got really interested in this ethical problem. I didn't really unpack it much further beyond what I've just discussed and beyond what I've written in a paper. But it's only really, I think, about 2 years later where we had all of these stories in media around artificial intelligence and facial recognition becoming such sort of common things in the city and in public space as well as in private space, really. And that's where I reminded myself of this ethics problem. And look, I'm not the only one, of course, thinking about the ethical problems of these technologies, but that's where I got really interested and where I really identified the opportunity to involve the public, the community, in conversations about ethics. Very often when you talk about ethics of technology, you end up in really complex literature that's full of jargon, literature that's usually written by ethicists, and no offense to ethicists, they're all great people, but very often very sort of theory-driven conversations rather than practice-led interrogations. And I think that's what technology ethics need these days, close involvement of people that are being confronted with new technologies. And I'm sure every single one of us has an opinion, whether you're a university professor or whether you're a bricklayer, everyone has opinions around whether or not a smartphone in your hands is a great thing or whether or not a camera in your street is a great thing. And that's really, So long story short, that's where I identified that opportunity to have a more participatory discussion around ethics.
And thanks so much for sharing that. It's really interesting. I really enjoy listening to how people like came into the space and those stories, because we all come from such different backgrounds, right? And things can really then lead us into this smart community space. And obviously, again, there's so many parts within it as well. So we'll continue to move and grow. And yeah, ethics is a huge topic. It is always, but more and more in the technology space. And I think people are starting to ask more and more questions too, which I think is always a good thing. And being more informed about what it is we think is okay and not okay. And I imagine this has kind of shifted over time as well, as things that didn't exist before we didn't have an opinion about, obviously. But when they first came out, we had a certain opinion, but then over time it morphs and it changes.
Yeah, I think with ethics these days, especially, what we need is to be able to respond really quickly and in a really sort of agile way. And that is, to me, what stands out in the more traditional approach to debating ethics. It's usually a fairly slow process where ethical insights and discussions around values. They are formed over a significant period of time. But with technology, we simply can't afford that. And in a similar vein, we can't afford that delay when it comes to developing policy, for instance, around technology use and technology deployments in the public space. We need to be extremely responsive, or it is simply too late and we are dealing with significant issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to talk about your projects, but we'll lift up a little bit first to, yeah, we'll go high. So what is a smart community to you?
Ooh, I think a smart community is, we're all smart communities, and I think we have always been smart communities, but I think a smart community is that kind of community that is sort of, that feels empowered enough to be vocal about issues that they are facing today or that they are likely to face tomorrow. So I think it's more than just your sort of neighborhood group or community being vocal about a community or a council implementing a change. It's probably more sort of council driven, for instance, where there is a person or a team that scrutinizes new initiatives and new ideas, especially when it comes to technology. So I think personally, a community that has the Ring doorbells at their front door, I wouldn't necessarily call them smart communities. These are the sort of perhaps the red flag communities in a way. But I think the people that scrutinize that, for instance, that they are probably the sort of smart community leaders or opinion makers.
Yeah, I like that. And, you know, I think it's shown the maturity in the conversation of how it shifted and changed. It like has changed over time, because I think there is, you know, there's technology, there's data, there's new applications, new widgets, new sensors, et cetera, that communities can invest in. But actually, it's that next level where we're actually asking the question of why. Why are we doing this? And is this the best way to do this? And who is being impacted by this, both in a positive and negative fashion? And bringing in those other things that are really important that maybe a technologist might not bring to the table, but the stakeholder engagement people, the privacy people, the ethics people, bringing those to the table so we can actually have a proper solution.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying is spot on. And I think that is really that definition of the word smart, that for a very long time throughout the 2010s, I think we've been led by the idea that smart means tech, and the more tech we have, the better. But in many cases, as you argue, I think I agree, that isn't really smart, because we are introducing biases, or we are discriminating against already vulnerable populations, for instance, or we are introducing tech that we now see has no meaning or no value or underperforms significantly. So yeah, that's absolutely the idea, that we need to trigger a shift in how we look at the word smart. And for me, smart is indeed something that benefits the wider population.
Okay, let's talk more about you. I want to hear about the projects and things that you've been working on. Now, last time was 2019, when we were in Bendigo at the Bendigo Innovation Festival. I'm getting the name wrong, but it was amazing. I heard you speak there and I was like, oh, got to get Niels on the podcast. Now, that was 2019. So things happen real fast around these parts, but you did speak at another conference for the Australian Smart Communities Association, which was awesome as well. So let's go to you. Tell us about the projects and things you've been working on. Start wherever you like and wherever you end up.
Yeah, cool. I think the key project in the context of the smart community discussion is really Biometric Mirror. So Biometric Mirror is a project we started back in 2018. So the world was definitely a different place back then, but hopefully we are back in that place sooner rather than later. So Biometric Mirror is an interactive installation, an interactive research exhibit, whatever you want to call it, that's absolutely fine, but really a study study that invites the public to participate in the discussion about the ethics and the efficacy of artificial intelligence and facial recognition. What we did to build Biometric Mirror is build our own data set and our own machine learning model and whatever jargon you want to throw at it, that is quite provocative and quite controversial. So we are able to scan a person's face and distinguish a range of demographic attributes as well as psychometrics. So we are able to identify how intelligent you are, how responsible you appear to be, how weird, how emotionally unstable, you name it, we probably have it in our database. We have about 35, I think, attributes that we can distinguish from a face. That in itself sounds extremely interesting. And a lot of people, and I have a few requests from industry, they're like, oh, you should commercialize this because this is really interesting in industry X and industry Y, and I'm not going to name them. And probably it is quite interesting. Like, who wouldn't want to see how weird your face appears to be, right? And
oh God, mine would just be off the charts.
Well, I can confirm a lot of people are actually really interested. I think to date we've had about 100,000 people go through a version of Biometric Mirror. But really what we wanted to do with this is to showcase how easy it is, first of all, how easy it is to build controversial and flawed artificial intelligence systems and facial recognition systems. But also we really wanted to take away all of the technicalities, all of the legal conversations that are usually had and all of the complex sociological conversations. We really wanted to deliver something that, as I said before, that your neighbor builder from around the corner or your academic expert can talk about and can form an opinion about. Yeah, I think we kind of succeeded in delivering that. So very quickly after we launched that, that got quite a bit of media attention, mostly positive. And I think we set up a really good communication plan around this project because this could have easily been taken out of context. So yeah, mostly positive and quite international. And since then, that project has traveled. So we've showcased it at the World Economic Forum. We've showcased it at the World Bank. So they have a conference for developing nations to really talk about the sort of legal implications of new technologies, which is really great to see that a project as simple, because it is really simple in its own right, Biometric Mirror, to see that a project as simple as that could address the average Joe, but also really start to inform the discussions that policymakers and opinion makers are having. So that project has evolved in a variety of ways. It's traveling as an art exhibit. So that's a fantastic collaboration with Lucy McRae, who is a now US-based, but originally Australia-based science fiction artist. And together with Lucy, we developed a sort of speculative beauty salon. And we really start to ask questions around, okay, what does beauty, for instance, look like if artificial intelligence and facial recognition become commonplace? And what if, this idea of perfection becomes a bit of a shopping list and you step in front of a camera and the camera generates a list of improvements or tweaks or whatever it's called for you? Obviously, it's a quite satirical sort of work, and we are not generating a shopping list as such, and we're also not promoting this idea of perfection, but it allows us to venture into that space and to start discussing the ethics of AI beyond your typical research exhibit. So that's one of those projects. I think from there onwards, we obviously have published about the work, and we've published about some of the findings and observations and learnings from our dealings with members of the public. But it has also sort of given our entire team an opportunity to discuss with media how technology ethics should be discussed differently and how technology ethics is more than just facial recognition and artificial intelligence, but it really applies to our use of social media, but also young people's exposure to these technology. And very often they're sort of, I wouldn't say inability, but I guess the immaturity and the inability to respond adequately to all of the concerns that these technologies introduce, the fact that you very often sign your life away, basically, when you sign up to something. So that's one of those key projects, really.
So just going back, just so it's where we're clear, it's this project is to basically show the inefficiencies or the potential risks and consequences that if you just go, yes, facial recognition can tell you all of these things. So for example, it can give you level of, I think it's attractiveness, and then how suspicious you are and all these type of things. The idea is to show how problematic that actually is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're not just showing those numbers, and the numbers in themselves are already an enormous conversation starter. And very often people do see that their attractiveness is rated as low or average, but then they start to question, what does that mean? What is an average attractiveness, or what is an average weirdness? And obviously that's just how the computer sees you. So you compare well or not well against our sort of reference data set. And that's one important thing to flag. The reference data set we have contains 2,000 photos. In the world of AI, that is peanuts, and probably even smaller than a peanut. I don't know what's smaller than a peanut. A pea? I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's nothing, and that is ridiculous. Nevertheless, we could, technically speaking, and from a legal perspective as well, we could technically commercialize this tomorrow. And as I said before, we would probably find clients that are very eager to get to use that technology. So that's one part of Biometric Mirror, really showcasing that it's problematic. The second part, and it relates very closely to that problematic nature, is that we also presented people with a speculative scenario as to how their analysis and their reading could affect something in their life. So imagine, for instance, I'm perceived to be a very irresponsible person, which for the record, I don't necessarily think I am. I've got a 2-year-old who seems happy and alive. But imagine a computer thinks I'm irresponsible. Imagine that information is passed on to a recruiter and they automatically exclude me from management positions. Because indeed, who would want to hire an irresponsible person in a key management and leadership role? Or imagine that that same level of irresponsibility is passed on to an insurer and they automatically increase my insurance fees as a result. Some of these scenarios might seem far-fetched, but actually many of those are already happening, and especially the recruitment scenario that is actively being used as such. And very often an AI of some sort will analyze job applicants' information, submissions, and basically make a call, make a decision.
Yep. And it's like even just features that may seem fairly mundane or just regular, it's like, well, if the data going in says that, well, all managerial positions are middle-aged white men, then if you're not one of those people, then you get marked down automatically for no other reason than you don't look like the data set that says that these people are managerial or successful or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, absolutely. And the example you give has already, you're probably referring to the Amazon sort of debacle from, I think, 2 years ago now, where they had actually developed a seemingly cool and time-saving recruitment selection tool. The only issue is that they had trained it with the data that they already had of their own staff and their own job applicants, which in many instances were men, as in not women, assuming a binary gender. So what that indicated, and it was only after a few months of that system being operational, is that, women were automatically sort of put at the bottom of the list, because everything that had any reference to things that are typically done or where women are typically members of, they were just considered to be less valuable. Luckily, they pulled the plug on that project quite quickly.
Yeah. And from I have only read about it, it wasn't that the applications were like de-identified in the first instance, but references to like all-girls school and that type of thing. And the thing is, it wasn't saying that those things are bad or less than or whatever, but they did not appear in this successful data set. And that is where I think your project and many others opens up this conversation about, oh, right, it's not actually, there are so many factors that then can push you down. It's not just the intentional discrimination, which we don't want either, obviously, but there's these unintended things that you may not realize until you actually get down the line. You go, oh, I'm using historical data. Well, actually, we don't want to hire exactly the same people as we had before. Therefore, that's you can't use that data set. So what data set do you actually use? And so just bring, those conversations, which are really exciting conversations for me, because then we can actually see real change, which is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think especially when it comes to recruiting, for decades, if not centuries, we've always been biased when we sift through job applications. It's a thing. But with artificial intelligence or computers or whatever you want to call it, we just are at a really interesting intersection and crossroads, I think, because we are now at a time where we can actually start to amplify all of these biases, because we are able to process much more information much quicker. But very often the technical profiles and technical people will say, hey, but our system can actually learn and we can make it better. The question is, how do you make it better if it is already sort of built upon false assumptions and false ideals as well? What if, for instance, your system learns over time, but after day two, it gives a preferential treatment to white men, for instance? How can it become better? I mean, as a person and as a human, we know how it can become better and more inclusive, but a computer doesn't know that. And unless that information is fed into the computer by a person like you and I, but it's really hard to prevent those kinds of scenarios from occurring.
Exactly. And I think it's also then we need to understand, no matter how good our intentions are or our idea, how great we think we can make good decisions, no matter what, we have a bias and we're putting that into the system. So, yeah, I think that's an important distinction as well. For me now, you know, doing data science and building models and that type of thing, I go, well, no matter what my bias is, if I'm the only one looking at this and I'm the only one analyzing this, then my bias is in this no matter what. And whether that is, you know, that I'm looking for more, you know, unintentionally looking for, I don't know, more evidence to say that women were discriminated against or whatever the case may be in this instance, or that the data said this, that, and the other. No matter how much we do that, that's why I think for me, we need more people behind the code with all different backgrounds. So then we can actually start to question this and then shift and change these things, but then also feed in all these different experiences that we have to actually combat that bias issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when it comes to bias, it is a really hard discussion for a variety of ways. Like I can only hope that no one sets out to develop an AI that is intrinsically biased and discriminatory from the get-go. I can only hope that it doesn't happen. But it's really hard to identify these issues over time. And very often we've seen that it's the junior software developer, so to speak, that might identify an issue, but very often they're not in a position to speak up and flag issues. So it's more than just a technical discussion. It's really also a policy discussion and a discussion around how you create a culture where everyone is able to voice their concerns with senior stakeholders, and especially those stakeholders that deal with the dollar figure in the end. Because if a client is willing to pay for something, why would you? Well, it's not really a question because you should flag it, but why would you flag that what they have in mind is impossible because it introduces a series of biases? It's a really hard, complex conversation.
And even raising those type of things, you're so right. I guess what you're saying is like, well, they're going to make me do this whether I raise this or not, and potentially maybe I get pulled off this job and et cetera, et cetera, and gig economy, all those things compound all these issues, right? Yeah, no, it's so interesting. And I think also with that, it's raising those issues, but then having someone take them seriously, but then also having the policy, or I'm thinking like the quality assurance. It's not the same as, say, so I used to be a quality engineer, right? We used to go on site, it had to be this, this, and this. Yes, you can make a few changes if you could sign off, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very similar, but say with this model, that what are those checks and balances that we need to make? And also we're going to identify more and more things that we don't realize that are even going to be a thing now, but will be in the future. But how do you then continually update that quality process? And how many checks and balances do there need to be? And like, you know, go, oh, well, that's too hard. But we did it. We did it with bridges. We did it with roads. You know, we did it with the internet. Like, we've done all these things before, but yeah, it will be very...
Exactly. And I still remember, as you rightly point out from my architecture studies, that we've got, and this might not be the right English term, but safety coefficients, for instance, that you add on to the calculations for structural loads when it's a football stadium, because you know that football fans, they tend to jump at times. So it creates a sort of vibration in a structure you want to avoid it. Your entire stadium collapses, obviously. So indeed, we need to start thinking about models that allow us to do the same in technology developments as well. But I think it's really also having that sort of multidisciplinary perspective and an open conversation around what it means to develop something ethically. And of course, that involves your software developer as well as your business development manager potentially at some point. But there might need to be a more sort of overarching figure or profile that looks at that. I'm actually writing something at the moment, why there is a case to be made for architects to be involved in that discussion and to help councils, technology providers, engineering consultancies to rethink technology ethics. And I think, yeah, architects have a really interesting profile. They're trained to be multidisciplinary thinkers. They're trained to be fairly good communicators, typically. They are familiar dealing with what I just said, those safety coefficients, for instance, so they know what it means to develop something that is secure and sustainable and strong. So yeah, there is a real case for those creatives to be involved in these discussions as well. Because I think that's the point. Ethics is intrinsically creative as well. If no one, yeah, I think so, make ethics sexy again has been my motto until the whole make something good again has been abused for political reasons.
And I'm just thinking, like, I've had a couple of conversations with people on pod about, like, using art and using creative ways to really engage the community, because ethics is all well and good, but not super useful if all it is a form that you and I tick when we need to do a research project. What we want is we want it in front of people so they can go, oh, this feels a bit odd to me. What's happening here? And they ask the questions, and then we can think more deeply about this stuff, about what people do and don't care about and who we need to protect also, and what those experiences have been. So I think it's so important. I think we need to see more and more of it, where we bring the smart community space, we bring the ethics, we bring the data in front of people so then they can actually start to engage with it. They can touch and feel it. They can wonder why, and also feel like they can be involved in the discussion, because if they don't, then they'll just, you know, you can't get them engaged and involved if they think that, oh, well, I need to have a PhD to be able to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the T in the FAT. So when we talk about technology ethics, we typically talk about fairness, accountability, transparency. I think the first two are more or less, I'm not going to say ticked off, but we have a few sort of mechanisms in place to, I'm probably very optimistic, but to make sure that most new technology developments are somewhat fair, and we usually know who to point the finger at when things go wrong as well. So we know who's accountable. But indeed, I think you're right. There is a real opportunity to still tap into that transparency aspect of new technologies. Like, what does it mean to have a database of 2,000 photos and all of a sudden assume that you can distinguish people's personality profiles from that? And I think really giving young people, for instance, or sort of data savvy people access to that data set as well and form opinions in their own way, which is what we're doing with Biometric Mirror as well. So we do invite young people to engage with our data set in a variety of ways as well and really add to that discussion. And I think, yeah, you're absolutely right, for the community as well to voice concerns with their city council, for instance, or with a technology provider when they think things go pear-shaped.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just looking at the time. We're going to have to wrap up shortly, but I want to ask you about the future, but is there anything else you want to share from project perspective first?
There are a couple of projects that I think very often people might think that I work across sort of disconnected areas. So I do work a lot on placemaking projects and even some digital architecture projects as well. But they are sort of linked by this common thread, and it's really giving voice to communities. So I just collaborated on a large project here in Melbourne, which brings the facade of a building to life through architectural lighting and electronic screens. But with that project from the outset, we've really engaged First Nations stakeholders as well and really invited them to think with us what it means to bring a building to life, but also to build a building on unceded lands and also the significance of these lands for First Nations community members as well. So I think that's really the thread that links the work. It's not necessarily all centered around ethics or digital ethics or technology ethics, but it is really around giving voice to people's stories and knowledge and culture. So yeah, I won't go into too much more detail about that specific project, but it's definitely worth looking up as well.
Yeah, we'll put the links in the show notes so people can click away and find that and for your other projects as well. Okay, well, let's zoom to the future now. What are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
Look, I think it takes us back to the early days of biometric mirror. We started out focusing on facial recognition back in 2018. I think I said that we started a project because there were some concerning developments back then, mostly out of the US, an academic who developed a sort of sexual preference detection machine. And that was the key starting point for us to work on biometric mirror and to flag that that's an issue. But since then, the conversation about facial recognition, I'm not going to say has died down, but I think some really interesting developments have occurred. So San Francisco, for instance, has banned facial recognition throughout the entire city. Obviously, in Europe, we now have the GDPR, so introducing new privacy requirements and better protection for citizens as well. A lot of European communities have also started to ban facial recognition, which is excellent. At the same time, also worrying developments, the fact that some Australian cities have sort of city-wide face recognition systems in place as well. There's obviously also the social credit system in China that is becoming more and more sort of westernized as well and becoming sort of part of our society slowly as well, which is one aspect. I think the more worrying development for the future, I think, is our own use of media and applications that use our face and that use parts of our identity and store that in a system that we no longer have access to. And for me, that is predominantly our use of social media. When you start looking at privacy policies of the main social networks, for instance, it is very clear that by tapping a button that says sign up or register, you do actually sign part of your life and identity away. So you give access to your face, you give access to your voice, you give access to very personal, deeply personal aspects of your own life. Sure, you might get cheaper products in return, and you might be able to purchase clothing that you wanted for 20% off, or you might be able to buy new technology gadgets for 15% off because you've given up your face. But I think we really need to be conscious and have a conversation as a society as well about what the future, the long-term impacts of that are going to be on our personality, on our well-being, and on our identity, and whether or not we do want to sacrifice that for a few dollars more in our bank account.
Mm. Yeah, and I also think the really interesting conversation around children and how growing up in this digital age and not in a phone or whatever, but it's like my nephew, by the time he's, 12 or something, what digital footprint will he have that he has not decided on? And my sister's very much in the realm of he probably won't have much of a digital footprint at all. And she's very conscious of that. But others, and it's again, it's the choice of the parent then. Whereas when I grew up, I'm pretty old now these days, but there may have been a few articles and things of like when I was in the newspaper that went digital or whatever, but when you Googled me, it wasn't here's my, first birthday party and everything like that. And things that people won't want to be on the internet as well. And then what implications will that have? It's going to be a wild ride.
It is really hard. Like I obviously have family overseas. We now haven't seen each other for nearly 2 years. So, of course, we need social media to communicate with them to some extent. And you can turn all the privacy settings to the most sort of strict format or configuration. As a computer scientist, I do, of course, know, and I hope that the rest of your audience knows that as well, that it is still living on a computer system somewhere. And whether that's in Australia, Indonesia, Germany, Belgium, the UK, it doesn't really matter. It is still on a system that can technically be accessed by third parties. And nobody knows what's going to happen if one day my favorite social network shuts down or goes bankrupt or whatever. What is going to happen with that data? Who will have access to it? But also, who are the third parties that already have access to it today?
Yes. I think we could have another conversation. Maybe we should, because I think that it's really interesting. And also that, like, you know, we're talking about this. We don't have all the answers, right? But you have to ask the questions, even if you know you don't have the answer, and that the answer may not exist right now, because it's, it's not clear cut. Well, it's been so great to chat with you, Niels. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. We will have to have another conversation. I think there's lots to talk about. But last question, how can people connect with you?
I think the best way to connect with me is through Twitter. I'm at MediaTecture on Twitter, and that handle stems from my very old interest in urban lighting and digital lighting, architectural lighting. But yeah, I'm fairly active on there. I've got a bunch of other networks. LinkedIn is, of course, the second best option. Just Google my name and hopefully some positive first results show up.
I was going to say, yes, your digital footprint will be there.
It's fairly significant, I think.
Shined away your face, we'll be able to find it. So, yes. Well, thanks again for coming onto the podcast. And yeah, I look forward to our next conversation. We'll talk soon.
I do too. Thanks for having me, Zoe.
Thank you. Bye.
Are you looking for an engaging speaker, MC, or facilitator for your next big event? Then we've got you covered. Zoe is a go-to speaker, MC, and conversation facilitator with a difference. She's a master at simplifying the complex and making connections you might never see. Book Zoe for your next event. Email hello@mysmart.community or head over to her speaker page, www.mysmart.community/speaking.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter at smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.